Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, Britain's most boring radio station closes down. How is cable TV beating the recession? And BSkyB will make a profit. The latest way for your pet goldfish to program the video. Now everyone can do it. We investigate how to bypass British Telecom for cheaper foreign calls and how British companies are cutting their inland phone bills. It's been long predicted that solar energy would provide all our energy needs. New solar cells are bringing this dream closer. The BBC Daventry shortwave station closes. And are you a British inventor? How the Innovations Catalogue could help you? All this, plus of course your letters and all the rest of the bits and pieces you expect from Sparks, every week on Radio Facts.
I'm not content to be with you in the daytime.
BSkyB is poised to break through to profitability this month for the first time in its controversial history of heavy losses. Sources within the consortium are confident it will break even at the trading level before deducting interest costs. BSkyB's turnaround will surprise city analysts who predicted that the satellite TV network would not even reach operational break-even until nearer the end of the year. BSkyB is 50% owned by Rupert Murdoch's heavily indebted News International empire. Pearson, publisher of the Financial Times, and Chargeur, the French media combine, hold some 16% each, with Granada and Reed International accounting for 12% and 3.7%. Subscriptions generate some 80% of the venture's revenue, with advertising making up the balance. BSkyB has been running at an operational loss of around £1.4 million per week until the earlier than predicted upturn, due largely to the £2 rise in the price of monthly subscriptions to BSkyB's movie channels, to which 1.25 million of the 2 million or so households with satellite dishes currently subscribe. The subscription price for movie channels was increased from £10 to £12 for one channel and from £15 to £17 for two channels at the end of last year. This served to inject extra revenue of some £2.8 million per month. In addition, BSkyB's finances appear to have been further improved by the decision to drop a costly legal action designed to overturn the $800 million movie rights deal signed with United International International Pictures in 1988. BSkyB originally claimed that the UIP joint venture for the distribution and licensing of pay TV was anti-competitive and in breach of the European Community Treaty of Rome. UIP, for its part, argued that the satellite company represented an anti-competitive cartel itself. In the event, BSkyB and UIP have let it be known that costly and protracted legal proceedings have been called off. BSkyB has struck a long-term agreement with UIP in respect of films made by Paramount, MCA and MGM Pathé to be shown on its movie channels. BSkyB also struck a deal at the end of last year to provide a new service for TVAM during the last 10 months of the Breakfast Stations franchise. Meanwhile, advertising is reported to have benefited from the encouraging trend in growth of sales of satellite dishes. It is understood that close on 100,000 dishes are currently being sold each month. This compares with BSkyB's international target of 60,000 per month late last year, and sales of just 34,000 a month registered this time last year. BSkyB expects to gain extra revenue from cable television services, but the major thrust is in aggressive marketing of satellite dishes and the sale of its movie channel subscriptions. That report in The Observer by Stella Shamoon. And out of interest, at the moment, if you hunt round the junk shops and bankrupt stock auctions, etc., you can pick up the old BSB satellite receivers and dishes for about £50 a pair. Now, these, of course, include a DMAC receiver, so they won't be any good for the Astra satellite. However, they'll still work on the BSB satellite, but we're not sure how long that's going to be carrying on. It'll be carrying on for at least a year, and they'll be putting, I think they'll be re-auctioning the frequencies or something, but it's certainly worth having if you're an enterprising RF-type person. You could make a microwave link or something out of an old BSB receiver and dish, about 50 quid at the moment. So how has cable TV been doing recently? Here's John Terrett talking to Peter Saunders on BBC Radio Surrey recently, just before a cable TV conference in the area. So firstly, how expensive is cable TV?
It's a very, very expensive commodity to put in place. Nearly 80% of your capital investment is under the ground, not above the ground. We're the only country in the world where cable has to go under the ground, and that's where the major cost is occurred.
Is that the reason, then, that America is so far ahead of us, the fact that their cables can go on the pylons above the street?
It's a personal belief, but I just happen to think that's the case. And it's not only America, it's also Europe, in Spain and France and Germany. We're the only country where the cable has to go under the ground, and it's very, very costly to put the cable under the ground. As you can imagine, I mean, it's basically, you start a cable business trying to get past as many homes as you possibly can. You're then into socio-demographic categorization of homes, where you're trying to pass lots of terraced homes, perhaps council dwellings, and that sort of, to a degree, left the industry with a slight stigma. I personally believe cable is the rich man's plaything and the poor man's entertainment centre.
Well, now, the government 2 years ago gave the go-ahead for, I think, 70% of this country to be cabled. How is that going?
Well, all of the major franchises in the big cities throughout the country, and indeed in Scotland and Wales, have been taken. Our own franchise here in Croydon serves Sutton, Merton, Kingston and Richmond. And we are now probably, well, we have all of Croydon cabled, which is about 120,000-odd homes can actually benefit from receiving cable television if they so choose. And we're probably a third the way through the other build in our franchise areas of Sutton, Merton, Kingston and Richmond.
So you reckon then that a third of the people who can access cable television in Croydon do so?
That's right. Yes,
that's not a bad statistic, is it?
No, it's a very good statistic.
Do you think that there will be a similar take-up in other parts of the country?
Well, the cable industry is measured on a word called penetration. That is the number of homes that you can actually service that you've passed with your cable along the footpath. That's called the penetration figure. And we in Croydon are now achieving something like 26-27% penetration. In America, the penetration figures are up around the 60s, 70s. and in other countries they are indeed much higher than that.
So I just want to be clear about one thing. Do you also send along your wires to your customers, BBC One, ITV and
yes,
Channel 4, and
yes,
so therefore
do.
Claim that they're watching cable when they're really watching those channels?
One could argue that. In fairness, in an area like Surrey, a lot of people cannot receive good quality pictures on BBC One, BBC Two, ITV 3 or Channel 4 because they live in hills or in valleys or whatever, and therefore we can offer a much clearer picture, and a lot of people take our service as opposed to trying to put master boost head aerials on their roofs at some considerable expense, I might add, to try and get a what is called a good national terrestrial picture. So yes, we do.
And finally, what is the conference going to achieve today? What are you going to be talking about?
Well, it's a very positive feel to the conference. A lot, you said it's a very new, young, embryonic type of industry in this country. It's a very exciting industry, and indeed we've gone through the ambers and the reds and the ambers again, and I think this time there's a far more positive feel. The satellite dish sales are increasing. I think somebody will quote later on that they actually sold 100,000 dishes in November and 110,000 in December or whatever. There's more awareness to multi-channel television in the public's eyes in general. And we've lost the stigma of it just being old movies, loads of sport, that sort of thing. It's now a much more progressive industry with much more to offer the consumer.
Of course, the recession helps you, doesn't it, eh?
Well, to be quite honest with you, for our basic system for 36 channels is £11.95 a month. That's all. That's just on £3 a week. And without knocking the video shops, you don't need me to remind you how much it costs to hire one video for one night. And we can provide 36 channels of television for £11.95. So in fairness, the recession isn't affecting us, thank heavens, quite as much as it would affect perhaps the car industry or any of the other luxury industries. And in fact, if you're looking at the BCD type of consumer, they are going out less, they're spending less on outside entertainments, they can stay in at home and watch multi-channel television.
John Terrett talking to Peter Saunders recently on BBC Radio Surrey. So a letter from Paul Endine. Brackley is in Northamps is where he lives. Just a quick note to let you know that I'm listening. I used to listen to you a few years ago from Ireland. I rediscovered you just before Christmas. I listen on a Sony ICF 2001D on its telescopic aerial. I find 6205 is generally better than 3910, but not always. I usually listen to Sparks, but not the music programmes, as music doesn't sound very good on HF. Well, Paul Endine, thanks a lot for writing. And another letter here from Michael Hanselman from Niederkruchten in West Germany, or Germany in general, I suppose, these days. Long wire 41 meter aerial is what he's listening on 3910. I think it's good when you talk over your post from your listeners. It's interesting and sometimes it's happy. Well, that's a happy letter from Michael Hanselman.
Oh, 777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC 777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
An intriguing story which exploits the use of calling number forwarding in the telephone systems these days. Bypass BT for cheaper United States phone calls. British firms are being offered savings of up to 50% on their international telephone bills by routing calls through the United States and bypassing BT. An American company is exploiting the high cost of international services from Britain by offering direct access to cheaper overseas phone systems. The move comes amid growing concern at the high cost of BT calls, which is being investigated by Oftel, the official telecommunications watchdog. With the new service, it is cheaper to be connected to Israel via New York than to dial direct with BT. Oftel welcomed the growing competition, which it believes could lead to lower prices. The service, which has brought down prices elsewhere in Europe, is provided by International Discount Telecommunications, IDT, based in New York. It is targeted at businesses spending more than £250 a month on international bills. The key is a computer located in Hackensack, New Jersey. A British subscriber dials the device, then hangs up after the first ring. Seconds later, a computer calls back, and the client picks up the receiver and dials the international number. The call to Hackensack is free, as technically it is not answered. The call originates in America, so the caller is billed at American rates. Firms which pay a £140 monthly subscription fee for the first line and £80 for subsequent lines can make substantial savings outside Europe. Callers to New York using IDT pay £1.49 for a 5-minute peak rate call, half the BT price. The service does not cut the cost to the continent, but IDT said it showed how European customers were overcharged. We hope we can help break up the monopolies the national carriers have on international calls, said Howard Jonas, its president. Jonas said that since launching in October, he had signed up 150 companies worldwide, including 8 British firms. BT, which cut its international charges by an average of 10% under pressure from Oftel in September, said it was happy to see increased competition. It's an interesting development, but as prices are driven down throughout the world, it may be short-lived. That comment by BT. And that was by Ian Birrell and Mark Skipworth in the Sunday Times.
In Electronics Times, enveloped with profit. The mail order catalogue Innovations is taking UK inventors seriously, reports Richard Baum. Andrew is talking rubbish. Dustbins, to be precise. Most people have got a bin, and most people are happy with their bin. But I believe there is a problem with existing bins. Jenny Scott nods patiently as senior buyer for NSP Group, home to mail order distributor Innovations. She has spent much of the last 2 days talking to people like Andrew. By day, Andrew is a joiner, but by night, he and his business partner Matthew become MA Designs, home of the open-ended ratchet spanner, the easy-loading paint roller, and now the Bin Buddy. In its prototype form, the Bin Buddy looks like a piece of plastic someone has heated in their kitchen and bent into a tube. Gas Mark 4, confirms Andrew. But with a slit running down its middle and a sticky pad on its flattened underside, it is obviously no ordinary tube. Put a roll of bin bags inside and stick it to the bottom of a kitchen bin, and the tube becomes not just a bin bag dispenser, but a revolution in refuse management. For 2 days late last year, Innovations threw open its doors to the nation's inventors, inviting anyone with an innovative finished product or working prototype that is in manufacture or ready to manufacture to meet its prototype buyers. So popular was the offer that by the end of the second day, the reception at NSP House could have done with a good going over with Innovation's own carpet master. Gives you the results and not the expense of a professional cleaning system. Carpet Master is one of the few items sold by Innovations that was developed by a UK company. These 2 days are designed to try and bring some British products into the catalogue, said Clive Beharrell, Managing Director of NSP Catalogue Holdings. Among the digital rulers, spider catchers and contact lens cleaners featured in the Brash Innovations catalogue, regularly tucked into Sunday colour supplements, only 10 to 15% of the products are made here. We are conscious of that fact, and I think it's a very poor statement on the state of British inventions, said Beharrell. Even when British goods do find a place in the catalogue, they seem dull alongside clever electronic gadgets brought in from US and Japan. That point was brought home in a recent edition of the catalogue. After flicking through pages of DIY acupuncture kits, abdominizer muscle developers and solar-powered car battery chargers, readers were treated to a Made in Britain section that suggested the nation's inventors were only interested in keeping their homes clean and tidy. Britain used to regard itself as the home of inventions, said Beharrell. In the United States and Japan, invention is regarded as absolutely necessary to survival, whereas here it is regarded as high risk unless you've got a track record. Despite the low profile of British inventors, Innovation's bestseller comes not from Japan, but from a small suite of offices in North London's Golders Green. Silicon Publishing has sold more than 1 million electronic language translators worldwide, including 50,000 talking interpreters sold through Innovations, and Beharrell takes considerable pride in his part in its success. What's been gratifying about that project is beating the Japanese at their own game. Inventors like Paul and Ian Rice, the brains behind the much-copied interpreter range, deserve much support from UK manufacturers, Beharrell believes. With a totally original product like that, the rewards are that much higher. We have to get people to understand that high risk can mean high reward. We were well into a six-figure investment with the interpreter before we knew we had a product that worked. Innovations plays its part in supporting inventors by helping them take prototypes through to production, occasionally investing its own money. The major mistake they make is that enthusiasm overrides commercial reality, said Beharrell. If they try to sell a product alone, they have got to be a financier, an engineer, and a marketing man. Plus, they need legal expertise. It's just not realistic. No one's pretending inventors have a high degree of financial and marketing skills, and that's what we bring to the deal. Innovation's willingness to help develop products has been rewarded by phenomenal growth in sales. Since Beharrell set up the company with a partner in 1980, NSP Group has seen its turnover grow to £40 million. It also set up 13 leading-edge shops and in 1988 merged with Clean Easy Holdings. So how does the company choose what to carry in the 40 million catalogues it distributes each year? Scott explained, "We look for products that answer a problem everyone has. We look for products that are new to the UK market, that are practical and useful. One popular category is new versions of old ideas, such as a hot water bottle filled with gel that heats in a microwave oven and stays warm all night. Products such as these sell well because their benefits are immediately understandable. So it is with the Bin Buddy. No more time wasted fitting a new kitchen bag. Simply reach into the bin and pull one from the dispenser. There's just one problem. At £3.95, it's too cheap. We look for a minimum sale price of around £5.95 because of the cost of processing orders," Scott tells the inventors. Their disappointment is brief, however, because Scott tells them she also buys for Clean Easy Home Care and will consider it for their door-to-door sales catalogue, so the Bin Buddy may yet have its chance to cheer up unhappy bin owners everywhere. That's Richard Bohm writing in Electronics Times.
We'll be right back after this
word.
Hi, honey, I'm home.
It's time to get busy.
Television.
So white and chocolatey, too.
Television. It's so fresh.
Look at that shine.
Look at that shine.
Look at that shine.
Oh, yes.
Lemon.
Chicken.
Liver.
With more eyes.
Hey, Mom, can I have some more?
We'll be right back.
After this word.
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 Now how much would you expect to pay now?
Bargain!
Have your credit card?
Bargain!
Ready.
Here's all you do.
Not just one. Not just two. More than three. You get four and more.
It's fresh.
You pay only $9.99. This offer may never be repeated.
$29.99.
Operators are standing by.
$29.99.
Absolutely free.
Oh, yeah?
We'll be right back.
After this word.
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 We'll be right back.
This word.
We'll be right back after this word.
Order, here's all you just call this toll-free number and have your credit card ready. Your size and color. Please allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery. Offer not valid in Kentucky, South Dakota, and Hawaii. And don't forget, with every 7 you order, you get one free.
Iron, niacin, and riboflavin.
Shake.
Get down.
Hamana.
Call before midnight tonight.
Hamana, hamana.
Soft.
Oh, yeah.
And manageable.
Oh, yeah.
Plump.
And.
Tender.
And. Batteries not included.
We'll be right back.
After this word.
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 We'll be right back.
We'll be right back after this word.
Quickly.
Some news on a book just released, Secret Signals, The Euro Numbers Mystery by Simon Mason. The ending of the Cold War hasn't brought out a corresponding end to the mystery stations sending out coded numbers night and day all over the shortwave radio bands. Here's a fascinating look at the numbers stations of Europe from a man who's studied them for years, monitoring thousands of transmissions in the process. Many of these mystery stations can be heard in North America, and this book is an indispensable aid to tracking them. Learn about Bulgarian Betty, Papa November, the Lincolnshire Poacher, Swedish Rhapsody, the Russian Man, and many more. This book includes numerous traffic excerpts, identifiers, schedules, and clues turned up by hearing mistakes in transmissions. Includes a full bi-frequency log with over 300 entries, complete with notes on formats and schedules. It costs $9.95 plus $2 shipping and handling, $3 if you're ordering from outside the United States. Probably the easiest way for people in Britain to order is to use a Visa or an Access card. That's TR Publications, and the phone number is 414 in the USA, 248-4845, and the address, TR Publications, TIARA, P.O. Box 493, Lake Geneva in Wisconsin, that's WI, 53147 USA. That's $9.95 plus $3 shipping for Secret Signals, the Euro Numbers Mystery by Simon Mason. Here's a letter from Paul Till. I enjoy listening to your station on the 49-meter band. I enjoy the media and country and western programs, and including the Steve Conway and Radio Caroline tapes. Thanks to Paul Till for that.
Here's part of a piece on the In Touch programme on Radio 4 about Serena Lovelace, who prepares old recordings ready for release on CD.
And when I popped down to see her in her studio come flat a couple of weeks ago, it was reverberating to the sound of this early 1960s rhythm and blues recording by Frank Irvin.
I said to my wife, my darling wife, what is this I see? A car is parked up in the drive where no car ought to be. My wife said, you fool, you crazy.
And with the tape still running and keeping one eye on the sound level indicator, Serena explained what she was doing with it.
That's right. I've got the original tapes from a studio in California, old acetate style tapes, not the sort of thing you see nowadays, and I'm copying the music as accurately as possible onto the digital format for later use on CDs. This music will be reissued mainly for specialist collectors on CDs.
Now, I suppose it must be fairly important to get your recording levels correct when you're copying off like this. How can you be sure you're doing it right?
I've come up with a new piece of equipment which has only been out a few months, which brings up the peak level, the highest level, in number form, so I can actually see the numbers, something like 2.3 dB or decibels. The way this works is it works in combination with a memory button, so that as I'm playing through my half hour, the old open reel analog tapes last usually about half an hour, there might be, say, 10 3-minute rock and roll tracks, and I'll press my memory button on the meter at the beginning of each one, and as we play through the track, the peak will be refreshed or updated, so that at the end of the track I'll be able to see exactly what the highest level was, and then if that was too low or too high, or it's flashing at me because it's gone over the top, I can go back and replay that track and get it just right.
With your degree of visual impairment, do you have any problems with reading the meter itself?
Oh yes, the meter I've been talking about is a very special, as I say, a new type of meter, which you only get really on digital equipment. That's made all the difference to me because it's very accurate.
Now, you've got one little gadget that you find helpful both in reading fluorescent meters and other close work, which perhaps you could just show us, a sort of little portable lamp that you can attach.
That's the noise of this lamp opening up. It's a very small, very portable little lamp, not very bright, but as you can get it so close to the object you're looking at, it can be very useful. It's mounted on a big clip, like a large crocodile clip.
And that can be angled more or less how you want, can it?
Yes, it can. It was designed originally, I think, for use, as you say, either on shelves or on a book for reading in bed, that kind of thing, when you didn't want to disturb your partner in the room, you could slip this onto the cover of the book and you'd have your own little area of light. But I use it for equipment where I do have to struggle with LCD, liquid crystal display, where the more light you shine onto that display, the better the contrast between the black and grey. It's always poor, but this does improve it.
That was Tony Berenger talking to Serena Lovelace on In Touch.
In The Guardian, Digiturst may have solved one of the challenges that perplexes personkind: how to program a video recorder. Indeed, its new system can record TV programs you want to watch, even if you don't know they're on. Next month, Digiturst will launch the MicroEye TV1, a PC expansion card that decodes broadcast teletext, i.e. CFAX and Oracle. The software supplied with the card will capture frames and import these into Microsoft Windows, where they can be scanned as a background task. It's therefore possible to look for keywords that appear in program listings or in subtitles, which are also broadcast on teletext. Since a TV1 card can also control a video recorder, it could be directed to turn the video on and off to record programs, or just turn it on when keywords come up. All we need now is a robot arm to insert blank cassettes and a pair of robot eyes to watch the stuff for us. That's in The Guardian.
Sharona, have the fullest, give it up, such a dirty mind, I always
Solar Energy in The Guardian. David Thurber explains how just 323 square miles of solar panels could supply all the world's energy needs by the end of the decade. Within decades, deserts could shimmer with solar panels supplying most of the world's energy. At least that is the prediction of Yukinori Kuwano, whose company, Sanyo Electric, is a leading manufacturer of solar cells. Kuwano, general manager of research and development at Sanyo headquarters in Japan, calculates that world energy needs in 2000 could be met by just 837 square kilometers of solar panels, covering a mere 4% of its deserts. Superconducting cables would carry the power to regions with less sunlight. It's achievable, he says, although some industry experts are skeptical about relying so heavily on a single energy source, particularly one that is still prohibitively expensive. Kuwano has spent years working on his own projects at Sanyo. He admits he failed in his initial dream to produce computer memory chips from amorphous silicon, a cheaper form of the element used to make semiconductors. But in 1973, his personal project research, done by staying late at night and using money saved from his regular research budget, paid off when the world oil crisis arose. Kuwano used his experience to develop solar cells. As a result, Sanyo became the first company in the world to make amorphous silicon solar cells. It is now the world's leading maker of amorphous silicon cells, which are frequently used in calculators and other similar consumer goods. Kuwano's dream is simple: a world powered by huge arrays of solar cells linked in international grids, with the sunny side of the world providing electricity to the dark side. Such a system, he says, would replace declining petroleum supplies and dramatically lessen pollution, acid rain, and global warming. It's a very clean process. He calculates 837 square kilometers, or 323 square miles, of solar cells could produce energy equivalent to 3.7 billion gallons of oil, or the anticipated annual consumption of oil, coal, hydropower, and all other primary energy sources. There's no doubt in the long term that solar cells will play a large role in supplying the world's electricity, says Dr. Jinzaburo Tagaki, head of the Citizens Nuclear Information Center, which studies nuclear power and alternative energy. What is important, he says, is to have a mix of different sources of energy that are appropriate to each area, including wind power and hydroelectric power. The most serious obstacles to widespread solar power are economic. What will be really challenging, says Roger Taylor, senior utility engineer at the United States Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado, is bringing down the cost of solar power. Solar power, he notes, is still 4 to 5 times as expensive as the kinds of power now plentiful. The price, though, is steadily decreasing. A solar panel which produces 1 watt of electricity costs about $5 today, compared with nearly $200 15 years ago, and should drop to 50 cents by 2015. Kuwano says this will make solar power competitive with any kind of electrical generating plants. If we achieve that target, all electricity can be provided by solar cells. Annual power production by solar cells now is estimated at only 46.5 megawatts, the output of a small generating plant. Japan is the largest producer, accounting for an estimated 16.8 megawatts, or 36%, followed by the US with 14.8 megawatts. Sanyo produces about 30% of Japan's total output. Kyocera Corporation has 27%. Lower prices depend chiefly on cost efficiencies attained through greater production, those involved say. To achieve that, Japanese makers of solar cells are promoting their product as an already viable energy source. Kyocera, which plans to double solar production capacity this year from last year's 3 megawatts, is backing solar car races and developing a solar commuter car, which it hopes to put on the market for $11,000 within 5 years. Sanyo has developed solar house roof tiles and solar sun roofs for cars, which power a ventilating fan to cool the car's interior on hot days. But the company says the first product likely to have an important effect on power supplies is its new solar air conditioner. Technicians at Sanyo's main cell plant in Sumito hope the air conditioner can significantly reduce electricity demand peaks in summer months. The unit is the same size as a normal one, but its power generating panels cover most of a house roof. At the US Energy Laboratory, Taylor said the air conditioner could reduce the need for new power plants because in both the United States and Japan, peak electrical loads are largely determined by air conditioning demand. Sanyo hopes to sell several thousand of the air conditioners next year for $11,000 each, and eventually will be able to reduce the price to around $4,000. That was David Thurber in The Guardian.
A letter from Vic Maddox. I'm a listener of Radio Facts and find most of your technical programmes most interesting. However, I have heard you have been transmitting programmes previously produced by the Radio Caroline organisation. If this is the case, could you please let me know when this happens, as this will make my listening entertaining as well as interesting. Thanks again for the good work. From Vic. Well, Radio Caroline can be heard on this station fortnightly on Wednesdays, every other one. And you're listening to Radio Facts. It's 6205 3910 and 12255. The programme today, Sparks, our weekly look at science, technology and media news, presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. If you've got any comments, then the address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And if you send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1, you can receive our station card, which includes technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. The address again, Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And thanks to Andy Cadier for writing to his MP, who's Employment Minister Michael Howard. I'm waiting most eagerly, notebook in hand, for his reply, or that he gets from the DTI. And talking about Radio Facts, he says, if it's illegal on a pirate, not licensable in the UK, not provided by the BBC, it's the citizens' band syndrome all over again. Thanks to Andy Cadier for writing to his MP, and if you'd like to do the same, point out that the current broadcasting bill, etc., has no provision for HF shortwave broadcasting, and it's currently a monopoly by the BBC, and you think you agree with us that there should be some private services in the shortwave band, and it's not as difficult for them to license as they might make out. So another quick letter. Vladislav Kozhuk in Tolyatti in Russia, who listens on a Volna K1 military communications receiver with a long wire, and he's been picking us up on 12255. I'm 19 years old, a DXer, and I work on the Lada automobile factory, where I serve at the controls and regulators apparatus. Fascinating, the things people do around the world. A Lada employee there writing in to us.
You and me could escape and hold the key.
This week on Sparks, Britain's most boring radio station closes down. How is cable TV beating the recession? And BSkyB will make a profit this year. The latest way for your pet goldfish or anyone else you like to program the video. We investigate how to bypass British Telecom for cheaper foreign calls. It's been long predicted that solar energy could provide all our energy needs. New solar cells are bringing this dream closer. The BBC Daventry shortwave station closes. And are you a British inventor? How the Innovations Catalogue could help you.
Now time for a good laugh. Britain's most boring radio station, Airport Information Radio, launched with much hype and fanfare by its managing director John O'Monier from Radio Mercury in Crawley, has closed down. This is how the story was reported on Media Network.
From switch on to a switch off that's quietly occurred in Britain. The initial switch on for the station was 18 months ago and attracted a Minister of Transport to the opening.
Well, I'm delighted to declare the radio station open and not to stand in the way of its first transmission.
For the first time at 11 a.m. on the 25th of June 1990, you're listening to Airport Information Radio, making broadcasting history with our live travellers information service.
This is Airport Information Radio, Heathrow.
Hello, Jonathan. This is David Miller from Horsham, West Sussex in the UK, with a report that both the Gatwick and Heathrow Airport Information Radio stations on 1584 kHz were taken off the air at midnight last Friday, as the broadcast didn't meet the required standards set by the radio authority.
It seems the owners were given 5 weeks to improve the service, matching the conditions of the original licence. But they couldn't raise the required funds. So we'll see what they do now with a spare medium wave frequency.
Probably fewer listeners to that station than to any shortwave hobby pirate. So that's 1584 kHz medium wave cleared of pollution by two 60-watt transmitters at Heathrow and Gatwick. You heard the silvered tones of sometime Transport Minister Cecil Parkinson not standing in the way of anything. And that was a report by Jonathan Marks on Radio Netherlands Media Network. And it remains to be seen how much it will cost the local county councils to remove all these signs around the M25 motorway, advising motorists to tune into the thing.
Try not to sound too downcast, Trevor, will you? It's not something that we didn't predict. Anyway, onto a rather sadder station closed down now.
The folks who lived on the hill. Daventry was once a name on every radio dial. Now, after 66 years, the BBC has closed the town's famous radio transmitting station. Byron Rogers in the Daily Telegraph mourns its passing. It was just a small news item, a single paragraph in this newspaper and at the bottom of a column. But that morning, many men suddenly felt older because of it. After 66 years, the BBC had decided to close its radio transmitting station at Daventry. It was the first of all its stations, but now the masts, which became the Northamptonshire skyline, are going from Borough Hill, 31 of them, from 150 foot to 500 foot in height, and covering an area of 200 acres. Because of them, men who once had crystal sets had heard of the small Midlands town. When Valves came to radio, its name was there on all the dials alongside places like Hilversum, whose location nobody knew. And not only in Britain. When a BBC engineer was posted to West Africa after the start of the Empire service in 1932, he found men there who had heard of Daventry. Coded messages once went out from the hill to resistance fighters in the Low Countries. It became the master pulsing station in the country's radar grid. If that had gone, the whole aerial offensive against Germany would have halted. It's ironic that peace has prompted the end. The Voice of America network, scaling down its propaganda with the end of the Cold War, has said it no longer needs the much more up-to-date BBC station at Wooferton in Shropshire. So the corporation has decided to switch its world service output from Daventry to its modern site. It's odd that Perestroika should have made its contribution to the history of Daventry, says Norman Tomlin, who started work there in 1939. Mr. Gorbachev won't know it, but he changed the landscape of Northamptonshire. Borough Hill, on the outskirts of the town, was chosen as being roughly in the middle of England. There had been an Iron Age hill fort, subsequently extended, to enclose an amazing 150 acres, at one end of which a big Roman villa was later built. Were the BBC to announce similar plans for such a site today, English heritage would leap up and down, but in 1924 nobody seems to have objected, and Daventry was to derive one-third of its entire revenue from the rates paid by the BBC. "You were very conscious of the hill's original inhabitants," Tomlin says. "All round you were the outlines of the ditch and bank they had built, and there was one part said to have been a Roman burial site. When you had to cycle there at 3 a.m, you got some very odd feelings at the back of the neck, with the size of everything, the loneliness, and the fact that the winds blowing through the masts gave a banshee wail hour after hour. It was a very odd place." About 20 people were employed, though by the outbreak of war there were 120. Tomlin recalls that to the town this was the mysterious place on the hill. Its engineers were a caste apart. They spoke with a different accent and even had their own club at the end of the high street, a castellated Gothic structure with net curtains. It is still there. The BBC in Daventry was a small colonial society. The Northampton newspapers were fascinated by the construction. As no road led to the hill, a light railway had to be built to carry materials. And when the towers finally rose, they stunned a local reporter. "There they stand, sharply defined against the blue, proudly disdainful in their 520 feet of rigid strength, of microbe men who seemingly as low as the proverbial tortoise approach their feet." Transmission at first was on long wave, subsequently on medium and short wave. "This is London calling the Australasian zone through the British Empire broadcasting station at Daventry." The world heard an old king for the first time and a young king for the last time. Leslie Turner started work as an engineer there in 1932. "It was such a complete world of its own," he says. "The BBC actually invited me to live on site, which I did, and I was there for the moments of drama, the time a German fighter machine gunned us, and when planes crashed into the wires, killing all their occupants. The atmosphere was curiously naval, perhaps because the BBC had recruited so many engineers from the sea. There were mess rooms, logbooks, rigging, halyards. The station was operational for 24 hours a day, with engineers listening to every program broadcast. My God, the row if you were seen without your headphones. You had your own weather as well," Tomlin says. "Even though the hill is only 600 feet above sea level, you could add at least 20 to 30 miles per hour to any wind they were experiencing in the town below. Winters were terrific up there. I remember 1947, when there was insufficient power to operate the factories of Birmingham, and we could see right into the heart of the Midlands. There was a purity of white I'd not thought possible." To him, it was a place of great beauty, a moonlit night with the clouds scudding and the red lights on the great masts and Daventry below you. Then there were the freezing fogs, which made the wires between the masts into a great glistening web. Life was dangerous then. The ice fell from the masts and the men had to wear helmets. When the fog set in the middle of winter, you felt you were at the end of the world, even at times on another planet. For in the early days of the Empire service, the aerials had to be switched by hand to cover different areas of the world, and you were out at all hours. From 9:30 to 11:30 it was Australasia, from 14:30 to 16:30 India, from 1800 to 2000 South Africa, and so on, as the planet turned and people woke and slept. The engineers on the hill, who did not sleep, moved the aerials, and in the fog a crazy comedy developed as some lost their way in the 200 acres or pressed wrong switches, spreading confusion all round the world. In the beginning, the hill was an open site. The war brought soldiers and barbed wire, and now security is very tight up there. The barbed wire of the 10-foot-high fences leans outwards, and there is a massive steel sliding gate. but there are no guards visible, just a device into which you speak your name and the purpose of your visit. And now, because of Messrs. Gorbachev and Yeltsin and the accountants, all this is going. Between 30 and 40 jobs are being lost. Nobody is sure what will become of the BBC club in the town. That, too, is kept locked as the last ghostly employees shuffle between its bar and the hill. Byron Rogers in the Daily Telegraph. And last time I went there, the place was shrouded in fog. And the other end of the story from Wooferton in the Shropshire Star. County beaming out BBC to the world. The BBC's World Service is set for a switch and from the end of March will be beamed from Shropshire. At the same time, BBC Wooferton near Ludlow will be scaling down its output for the Voice of America network. Wooferton's sister transmitting station at Daventry is set for closure after 66 years and the Shropshire station is taking over some of its work. Daventry needed £25 million spending on new antennas, whereas we have more up-to-date ones. And so, from the end of March, we will have the World Service, explained senior technician Peter Loveday. It has slotted in very well. We do not need extra staff, but it will mean we utilise the transmitters more, he said. The propaganda work of the Voice of America is being reduced, and transmitters at Wooferton will not be needed so much. And that was in the Shropshire Star.
Well, we had a report a couple of weeks ago about being concerned about microwave radiation being beamed out from on top of schools. It strikes me that looking at some of the men working at these high-power shortwave radio stations might shed some light onto any possible effects of high quantities of electromagnetic radiation on the body. Anyway, Malcolm Cairns writes from Gateshead in Tyne and Wear, I'm writing to say how much I enjoy Radio Facts programmes, Sparks and Paul Bentley's in particular. I first picked up Radio Facts on the 6th of September last year and have been a regular listener since then. Considering how clean your signal is, I'm amazed I hadn't heard you earlier. I first heard you on a Sony ICF-7600A on 6205 using only the set's telescopic aerial. I also have an ICF-2001D. I've been a shortwave listener since my school days and have some details of stations I logged in 1954, CBC, All India Radio, Cairo, etc., as well as the general overseas and Far Eastern services of the BBC. I've been a free radio listener since the early days of Caroline. Using a domestic receiver then, I could only pick up the station in the evening. In those days it closed down at 8 o'clock in the evening. I would listen until the last flourish of the organ music with which it signed off. As more stations came on air and their broadcasting hours were extended, I managed to pick up most of the ones located in the southeast during the hours of darkness. London and Caroline were my favourites. In this part of the world we had 270 Radio Scotland and of course Caroline North. In 1970 I was delighted when Radio North Sea International opened and with such a strong signal. When Caroline came out again and joined RNI and Veronica, it seemed that the good times were back again. Incidentally, if you have any archive recordings of the banter between RNI and Caroline during the early years of Christmas morning 1971, it would make great material for an archive programme. I have a snatch of it on a cassette tape as I tuned between the two stations. And talking of archive material, I have some tapes of the close down of RNI's international service on the 30th of August 1974. It would be good to hear Andy Archer and Brian McKenzie again over the airwaves. Well, unfortunately, Trevor doesn't have a lot of time to do archive programmes at the moment because searching and compiling each one takes about 6 to 8 hours, but he's hoping to do some more soon. In the 1980s, I did occasionally tune, whenever possible, to Caroline and Laser 558, although I must admit that their music output didn't appeal. However, that didn't lessen my disappointment at Laser's disappointment from the disappearance from the scene. I also listened regularly to Viewpoint 963, an interesting and unique station. The last time I picked up Caroline was in April 1991, a test broadcast on a Sunday evening, possibly its last. I'll spare you further reminiscences, but I must congratulate you on your resourcefulness and ingenuity in circumventing Whitehall bureaucracy, and also on the quality of programming. More power to your elbow. I don't have any IRCs. I've finally run out of 10-shilling notes. Would you please, therefore, accept this pound note? Best of luck with HF license application. Well, Scottish pound notes are most welcome. And there are also pound notes around in Ireland, but they're fast being replaced by funny little gold coins, just like ours. That's a letter from Malcolm Cairns, with lots of reminiscences. He's living in Gateshead, Tyne and Wear.
Fire! Fire!
Controversy in the Caribbean, ladies and gentlemen, undoubtedly and indubitably spells boots. B-O-O-T-S.
Searching in my mind, there's only two things I can find.
I have one desire and that's to dance until you drop.
Staring to your eyes, there's only two things I can find.
You have one desire and that's to dance until you drop.
Boots, by definition, who is one who's one to lose? Give anybody a chance, and that's the bull slop you know they're gonna use. Because Boots, he always lands and he always bends. He's got no rap, so he's got to find friends. Spends all the blue chips in a relationship, and the females take him for a lipstick bay. See him coming from miles away, and for the hell of it, they make him blow the week's pay. He thinks he's got class, they think he's an ass. Behind his back, they got the last laugh.
Your eyes, there's only two things that you love.
You have one desire, and that's to dance until you drop.
This, the final frontier.
Spinning big and talking loud, doing his best to me down with the in crowd. Always the first to pick up the check, but still yet, he don't get no respect. So, zip up step, that boy's soft. Zip-boops there, girly girlies rip them off. Zip-boops there, with his arms open wide. Zip-boops there, girls take him for a ride.
I have one desire and that's to dance until you drop.
Zip-boops deck with his arms open wide. Zip-boops deck, girls take him for a ride.
If you've spent hours hanging on the phone waiting for some helpline or similar to answer, here's a story from a slightly different angle. Users call the shots. Service provider options and discount schemes are making users demand much more from call management. Sarah Johnston, writing in Communicate magazine. Before it discovered call management, 4,000 customers a week used to get sick of waiting for Dixon's Financial Services to answer their phone calls and would hang up. The company, which markets personal credit and extended warranties through Dixon's and Currys stores, just couldn't get to the phone quickly enough to answer all the inquiries. Then it bought a system which told it how long callers were waiting, how many calls were lost, and how many calls were repeat ones. Armed with this information, the company decided to polish its public image. Now, if you're one of the 7,000 a week clamouring to talk to Dixon's Financial Services, the company claims it will answer your call in 10 seconds. A few years ago, installing such a call management system made Dixon's a rare case indeed. A survey conducted then by DataPulse showed that some 80% of businesses were doing nothing to control their use of the phone system. During the past 18 months, however, more British firms have realised the need to manage their phone in the same way as they would monitor any other corporate resource. Once, when companies were just trying to stop errant employees spending all day on the blower talking to family and friends, or perhaps hoping to catch out to British Telecom and Mercury as they came to grips with itemised bills, call management meant simply logging outgoing calls. Now the term not only refers to handling incoming calls in the most efficient way, it also involves choosing the right carrier to route calls made. For concerns large enough to have their own private network, voice compression and breakout calls, where the private network is used to carry a long-distance call almost to its destination, and the public network is used on the last leg, are also now options. These sort of technologies, DataPulse's managing director Hugh Crook says, can save a company between 10 and 30% of its phone bill. Whereas call loggers used to spew forth lines of phone numbers in black and white, most of the main call management systems on the market today present the information they collect in easy-to-understand tables and graphs. Software packages like Eclipse and Genesis from TISL, Christie's Ringmaster, and Databit and Systems Reliability products can handle both private and public network traffic. When connected to more sophisticated switchboards, they give a company an overall view of how it uses its phone system. They check how long it takes switchboard operators to answer, see whether calls are being answered by individual extensions, and report whether calls are having to be transferred to another department as soon as the operator puts them through. These systems can identify peak periods when phones are ringing and show when the company might need extra operators on the switchboards. By monitoring separate lines, they can also signal which parts of the system are over or underused. CallScan's marketing manager Mike Watmore says this can be especially important for customer service departments and telesales outfits, who want to work out how long it's taking their staff to deal with calls. In large call centres, operators can look up and see how many lines are still waiting to be answered. Real-time analysis also gives a clear indication of how many calls are coming into a switchboard, even if they drop out before being answered. Because call management allows companies to bill back separate departments for their use of the telephone, it has also found more commercial favour as British business has moved towards the Japanese internal market model. Databit's head of marketing says that hospitals opting out of the National Health Service, that is, taking sole responsibility for their own budgets, are becoming a prime sales target. Call management technology also enables companies to fix a grade of service for each employee, allowing them to use only local and inland rather than international lines. Or, if they find, as bankers Coutts & Company did when they installed the Genesis system, that employees' calls to directory inquiries are too big, they might wish to bar 192 and 142 calls and set up their own internal directory service. Since Oftel relaxed the network code of practice at the end of 1990, organisations have been legally allowed to route long-distance calls over their own private networks, breaking out to the PSTN, that's the public switched telephone network, or the ordinary phone lines to you and me, to complete the call. However, accurately charging these calls has proved tricky. For example, when a London-based employee makes a call to Aberdeen, his or her call will go to the nearest node on the private network, travel across that network to the node nearest its destination in Aberdeen, and 10 more from that node across the private switch telephone network to the number originally dialed. The result is that the company only has to pay a public carrier for two local calls rather than one long-distance one. But the Aberdeen office will get the bill for one of those local calls when both of them were run up by London. Lots of clever software involved here, you see. This article aimed fairly and squarely at bashing British Telecom. Mysteriously, BT did not wish to discuss the two call management systems it sells, much less say whether the aging IZICOM made by BTS or their software package had been modified to take account of the options scheme. Unlike many newer packages, it's not hardware independent, leading one good pundit to speculate that this good, proven but fairly unexciting product is facing a major problem. You see, there are now hundreds and hundreds of tiny companies snapping at the heels of British Telecom and hopefully eroding their enormous profits. And that's a bit of background to the hold jock story we ran a few weeks ago. Probably more sensible than making people wait on the telephone listening to records, don't you think?
In a review of Garrison Keillor's new book, set in the early days of radio, on the Radio 4 Kaleidoscope programme, reference was made to the boring predictability of radio formatting, which occurs these days.
Format or medium becomes profitable, then the standardization comes in. What this book is doing about radio is talking about it before everybody realized there was a lot of money to be made. It was spontaneous. People walked in off the street and they made it. And then when you move on to television, Frank himself walks into the television studio, pretends to be the man with the appointment, even though he isn't, sits down, reads the news, and nobody knows he hasn't experience because none of them have had any experience. But then profits are made out of TV, and that changes.
Yes, it's a great portrait, I think, of the golden age of radio. Well, Paul and Andy, thank you. A Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor is published this week by Faber and Faber at $14.99. If you enjoy the serialisation on Radio 4, it's now available on cassette from the BBC Radio collection. Keillor's fictional programmes aren't so very different from the real thing, as we were saying. His old WLT barn dance isn't that far from shows like Barnyard Jamboree on WOWO, W-O-W-O, Fort Wayne, Texas, or the Renfrew Valley barn dance on WLW Cincinnati. Well, it's all computerized now, but the music survives, as we'll hear from the Bluegrass Ramblers.
So, all the details there. Garrison Keillor's new book, about the time when radio was wild, called A Radio Romance.
Well, some bits are more wild than others. A letter from Bob Dobson in Sedbergh, Cumbria. I thought it was about time I wrote to you once again to say just how much I enjoy and appreciate the service provided by Radiofax. I first wrote to you in 1988, while I was living in North Allerton in North Yorkshire. I have since moved to this far corner of what is now Cumbria, but is historically the West Riding of Yorkshire. On the whole, reception of Radiofax is not as good here as it was over there, although it's reasonable on 6205 during daylight, and 3910 is fair to very good in the early evenings. My listening is done either on an ancient Trio TR9DS with a 5-metre vertical wire aerial, a nasty Sanyo portable rescued from the rubbish tip, as one does, using the kitchen radiator as an aerial, or an old Philips 3-valve mains set with the same 5-metre wire. Both the Trio and Philips live in the garage, or my lovely new Philips DC777, which I bought from you in August last year. I now have used this set all over the Great Britain, from the Isle of Lewis to East Anglia, and find the shortwave reception to be first class. We even listened to Radiofax while on holiday in County Kerry last September, and found reception very good there. I wonder why. The DC777 really is a first-class unit. The audio quality of your transmissions is invariably very good, and although the signal suffers from interference from other users some of the time, on either of the frequencies I can receive here, the general quality of reception is quite acceptable, and is an excellent example of what can be done with low powers using the appropriate equipment. I must say that I've found the original program format of Radiofax to be more enjoyable than the present one, although I appreciate the constraints under which you're operating. Sparks is far and away my favourite program, followed by the archive programs. The return of Caroline is most welcome, and I hope that your association with them will continue when they get back on air, in their own right. Not all of us have satellite receivers. Living now in a quaint Dales-listed cottage, I'm sure that the planners would not contemplate my putting a dish of any kind on my house. By the way, is the Revox Horn satellite antenna any good? Well, not sure. However, other Revox stuff is brilliant, so it probably is. I've listened to radio as a hobby during since the late 1940s and have derived an immense amount of pleasure from dial twiddling. I logged all the major pirates since the days of Radio Sid, after whom my big black Labrador is named, and CNBC, remember them? I have both closed downs of RNI recorded off-air on tape, as well as various snippets, including a 1970s ice hockey match recorded from CKVO, VOCM on 710 kHz in the days when you could easily do such things with a long wire, before the advent of 24-hour radio from most European stations. I don't do as much listening now, but I still get satisfaction from hearing the unusual and different, particularly on shortwave. I have once again done my little bit for the cause, and enclose with this letter copies of correspondence with my MP, and his stock reply, which doesn't really answer the question, and as usual hedges round the point. Most disappointing, but just about what we could expect from those in charge of such matters at the present time. I do think that phrases like, only the BBC are permitted to use, are just an establishment excuse to maintain their control over shortwave broadcasting in this country. Even the Commonwealth of Independent States, how the Soviet Union is now known, is allowing private enterprise to use the shortwave bands. It would not take much governmental effort to issue a few licenses for users such as yourself to operate on some of the many frequencies that are allocated to the BBC and are only very rarely used. Keep up the good work, and he sends all the very best to all the Radiofax staff. Thanks, Bob Dobson. And yes, it's the same letter from the Home Office with a new paragraph. Well, new sentence, more like. I am copying this letter to the Chief Executive of the Radio Communications Agency, Mr. Mitchell, because of his responsibilities for spectrum planning. Exciting stuff, as ever, from the Home Office. You're listening to Sparks on Radiofax every Monday and Tuesday. It's our weekly programme of science, technology and media news. Other programmes start on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays.
In the quarterly engineering information bulletin from the BBC, a piece about the BBC's new broadcasting house for Southampton. On September the 9th, television broadcasting from Southampton moved from the old premises at South Western House to the new purpose-built broadcasting centre at Havelock Road in the centre of town. Pat Turner describes the new centre. The BBC has had a presence in Southampton for over three decades. Until recently, the regional home has been a converted hotel, the old Southwestern Hotel, where existing home service wireless studios were converted to television use. Many of the remnants of a bygone age were still there, such as impressive marble-lined public areas and ornate plasterwork in the television studios. It did not make an ideal broadcasting centre. The newsroom was cramped, chimneys with real soot had to be used as cable ducts between floors, the studio could only be used on air with the ventilation system turned off, and equipment bays were crammed into every nook and cranny. Radio Solent, housed on a separate floor, had to face similar difficulties. The need for a new broadcasting centre was identified 10 years ago, a requirement which could give the opportunity to bring together both television and local radio in one bi-media centre. Five locations were considered, and the Havelock Road site came out favourite. At the time, it was being used as a municipal bomb site car park, the most significant feature being its slope. The ground falls away steeply from the frontage on Havelock Road to its lower end in West Park Road, a difference in level of about 8 metres. Further challenges came from the London to Southampton Railway running adjacent, artesian wells below, and the chimes from the Civic Centre belfry opposite. The main redeeming feature was its proximity to the centre of the city, and therefore its accessibility to the public. After extensive discussions with all parties, a project plan was drawn up and approved by the Board of Governors in March 1988. Work then commenced on the detailed design.
South and West region laid down a number of design requirements. Principally, there was a need to bring television and local radio together in a common newsroom and to maintain flexibility throughout the building, so that future changes in BBC policy and programming arrangements could readily be incorporated. There was also an urgent need to provide Radio Solent with new facilities, as the existing equipment had become a maintenance liability. Southampton City Council also set tight guidelines. In particular, the building should complement the Civic Centre. This is a dominant landmark in Portland stone with copper roofs, designed in the 1930s by E. Barry Webber. Its 50-metre-high belfry was a lookout for fire watchers during the Battle of Britain. The design adopted has a copper roof and artificial stone pilasters on a contemporary external shell. Care was also given to landscaping, as the site previously had the appearance of a relatively green park, as well as being adjacent to a pedestrian walkway leading to the railway station. The new building is unique within the BBC in that heat is provided by a geothermal heating system. A study was made of the options for fueling the new building, including the geothermal heating system run jointly by Southampton City Council and private enterprise. This had been operating for some years and was already supplying a number of nearby buildings. Brine is pumped 1.8 kilometres down a borehole to a hot aquifer. The returning fluid at 760 degrees Celsius is passed through a titanium plate heat exchanger. Heat is distributed around the city by pumps supplied with power from a CHP, combined heat and power diesel generator. Additional heat for standby is supplied by boilers in the Civic Centre. Use of the geothermal system releases space which otherwise would have been taken up by a boiler house and chimney. The running costs are comparable to gas and cheaper than oil. A minor disadvantage is that the heater batteries and radiators need to be slightly larger because of the non-standard temperature, but this was allowed for when comparing costs. That was by Pat Turner about the BBC's new regional broadcasting centre in Southampton.
I'll play this one for John O'Monier and everyone at Airport Information Radio. It's by Public Enemy and it's called Shut 'em Down.
Education. check, one hit the deck, let the man of the hour commit the soul power. For once I got to say, shut him down